Hello and welcome to In Your Nature podcast. I'm Ricky Whelan.
And I'm Niall Hatch. And In Your Nature is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly. And the series is supported by Laois, Offaly and Westmeath County Councils and the Heritage Council.
So Niall, I'm glad to be back. New season, new year, new season. But some changes since we last spoke. And so our listeners know, and when they hear further reference to it, I suppose in later episodes, they might know what we're talking about, is since we last did an episode, I have left Birdwatch Ireland on very good terms, I think.
We're still speaking to each other, Ricky, we are.
Yeah. So I survived 10 years at Birdwatch and I'm delighted. So nearly a decade at Birdwatch, and I've since moved to Offaly County Council as their new biodiversity officer. And people may have read or have heard that by the middle of next year, every local authority, every county council in the country is going to have biodiversity officers, which is a really, really positive thing for biodiversity, especially in the local authority. So looking forward to getting stuck into that. And but the other good news is that we're keeping on the podcast.
We are. So that was the very first question I heard. Actually, when I heard you got the job, I was like, can we still do the podcast? You reassured me immediately. You saw what I was thinking. And I'm delighted about that. It's fantastic. We get to continue to do this. Just to say, Rick, as well, congratulations on the new job. There's literally nobody I would rather see as a biodiversity officer in the country than you. So I think it's absolutely perfect. We get to continue to do what we love with this podcast. Just for the record, I'm still very much with Birdwatch Ireland. I'm still the head of communications and development with us, with Birdwatch. We're the largest environmental NGO in the country dedicated to conservation of birds and their habitats. And so we'll actually be working together quite a lot because we were still very much in the same sphere, and Birdwatch Ireland works a lot with local authorities when it comes to conservation.
Absolutely. And my first order of business in Offaly County Council is to get as many swift bricks in as many places as possible. So I'll be blamed for being a one-trick pony, but anyway, what the hell. It'll be grand. Hopefully, Offaly will be coming down with swift boxes and bricks over the next few years. But to start off in that vein, we've combined my new territory of Offaly with my love of birds, and we've started off with a birds and bogs and a bogs and birds episode.
Yeah, it was hardly going to be seabirds, was it, for Offaly? So no, bogs, perfect. When I think of Offaly and what's really special about that, it's the bogland. It's such a unique habitat, and it's really where Offaly punches above its weight internationally as well, and the surrounding countries as well. Let's not forget Laois and Westmeath as well too, which are also very good for it.
Yeah, look, the Midlands is coming down with bogs, and look, we hammered them for 100 years, and now we're sort of on a new a new plane and looking after them a bit better and re-wetting them and restoring them, and hopefully the birds and the biodiversity is going to benefit. So yeah, an episode dedicated to that. So I hope everyone enjoys it.
Yes, our boglands in Ireland are really underappreciated, I think. They're essentially our equivalent to the Amazon rainforest. They're so biodiverse, so important when it comes to climate mitigation, so important when it comes to the quality of water and air and soil and all these things. I still remember my very first time in a bog, Ricky, when I was a kid. I was there with my dad. And I think it must have been in Kildare. I'm not sure. I think it probably was. I was too young to remember that part of it. I remember walking along and being actually quite frightened of the place because it's all so squelchy. And then I fell down this hole up to my waist in this freezing cold, dirty water. And I thought, I hate bogs. This is horrible. What are we doing here? And since then, I've completely changed my tune. And I think they're the most glorious places on earth.
That's funny. I thought you were going to give me this really euphoric experience, a childhood experience of a bog.
Nope.
But equally, I have awful memories of the bog as a child, as a sort of as child labour, foot and turf, and doing all that stuff. So we used to just hate it, and it was like my gran had to be there rubbing his hands, licking his lips, couldn't wait to get on the bog. Like, they loved hardship, that generation. And he worked for Bordermona, of course, and so did some of my uncles in seasonally and all that sort of stuff. And Genie Mac, there'd be a line of tractors and trailers going up the lane. And to us, it was just hours of sunburn and dust in your eyes and backbreaking labour and tea out of flasks and all that. So that was kind of the nice bit, I suppose. But we used to hate it, but I sort of have found a very much a love for it since. But definitely my first experience of nature and wildlife were those same trips. Mm. And you'd lift a footing of turf, which is the stack, to throw it in, and often there could be a frog under there in the damp, sort of hiding from the heron or the sun or whatever, or loads of ground beetles, be sort of carabids everywhere, scattering everywhere. And that's where I would have first seen my first tiger beetles. Same with my first lizard I seen on the bog. And actually, the first lizard shed its tail was to my boot, trying to catch it. I sort of tried to stomp on his tail. I was like, geez, I know the crimes I've committed. Anyone from MPWS in Offaly, please switch off now. And that was my first experience there. And then dragonflies, I used to be terrified of. They were like these huge sort of... like helicopters, you know, those big Russian sort of military helicopters.
There's something kind of creepy about them, certainly. Yeah.
And they'd be eyeballing you because they're territorial. You'd be kind of like, you know, and so apart from that, and obviously frog spawn and all that sort of stuff, that was all from the bog. And that obviously all stayed with me, you know.
I remember you mentioned about dragonflies and bogs. I remember being at a bird ringing session on a bog and a dragonfly got caught in the mist net, which is always a disaster. How do you get this thing out? It gets tangled in this very fine net. Very hard to get out without damaging the dragonfly. And unfortunately, the thing was damaged. Its head actually came off in the process. Now, you'd think that would be fatal. Nope. So one of our colleagues brought this box back into the office. It had the dragonfly in this box, its head lying on the ground beside it. Dragonfly still flicking its wings, walking around in the box. And it stayed alive for the best part of a day afterwards.
Like, amazing, but also gross.
Very gross. And, but it sticks with you.
I thought you were going to say, like, you open the box the next day and its head was sort of like, you know, had regrown a head. And I was like, nah.
No.
Do you know what sort of dragonfly it was? Was it one of the huge ones?
I can't remember. It was one of the fairly big ones.
One of the big bluey green lads. Yeah. Cool. Emperor migrant or something. That's cool. Gross, but cool. And, yeah, I mean, they are whoppers and people are afraid of them. I know, you know, we see damselflies, which are much more dainty and sort of nice, and those banded damsels are just gorgeous along the riverbank and all that. And
the eyes kind of bulge out of the side of their head, they make them look like cartoon characters. They're kind of cute, whereas the dragonfly, there's something kind of almost sinister about it.
Yeah.
And they're killing machines. They're amazing what they do.
They're just too big. And, they're just a bit freaky. They're big insects. People are freaked out by fast-moving things and all that sort of stuff. But back to birds and bogs, and like, I can't get over it. I'm only in the job a few weeks as biodiversity officer in Offaly, and like, there's names of bogs coming at me left, right and centre, and there's the common name, and there's the name that's on the map, and then there's the local name, and then there's Jerry down the lane's name for the bog, and you're kind of, sometimes you're talking about the same bog but it's four different names, which is sometimes unhelpful. But it's amazing. There's so much heritage and obviously history and natural history in the bogs. But before we go too far down that path, let's bring it back to birds. But when I was a boy again, bogs and the birds associated with the bogs were very much ducks, because that's where, like, Granny would have went shooting on the bog. That would have been where him and his brother...
You get your teal springing up out of the drainage ditch and so on.
So when he'd say, oh, we're going shooting on the bog, and I go, what are you shooting, Granny? He'd go, duck. And what he meant by duck was he meant mallard and he meant teal. Mm-hmm. And then he'd say, oh, we might be lucky enough to get a few snipe. And, you know, there was always snipe on the bog, and we'll talk about those. And that was sort of it from a shooting perspective, I suppose. And that's what I knew of bogs. They were the three sort of species of bog bird. And then often you'd see the heron on the bog. Mm-hmm. And they'd be sort of looking for amphibians and stuff in the drains and all the rest. And then I always remember, and we probably won't go there in detail today because they're not really bogland birds or peatland birds or... not really associated, but there was always hirundines.
Yeah.
Because there's a profusion of insects in all those bog pools coming off. Those aquatic insects are hatching all the time, be it mosquitoes or whatever, and there's just a profusion. The house martins, the sand martins, and the swallows, and probably at the time swifts, which I wasn't aware of, were up there too, all sort of gorging on all these insects. And also, I didn't realise until years later, now when I visit the same bog down in Garry Hinch, just outside Mount Mellick on the Tullamore Road there, the sand martins used to nest in the peat walls that were sort of there from the cutaway. Yeah, so which is a bit of a phenomenon, and because we're used to them in sort of river walls and quarries and all that sort of stuff, but that we're using the peat walls from you know, industrial cutting and all that. That's why they existed there. But it's perfect, you think about it. It's a vertical wall. It's over water. There's plenty of insects in the area. It's ideal, really, for them.
Oh, absolutely, and they're nice and safe from predators there generally as well. So it seems I'd say they'd be perfect for someone like a sand martin. And I think you mentioning there about the insects, that actually just shows just how biodiverse bogs can be, because the presence of insect-eating birds like that, especially in abundance, it shows that there is a lot of food for them to feed on, and there wouldn't be that if it wasn't for the plant communities and all of the, you can go down to things like the bacteria that are in the peat itself. All of this, they all play a big role in supporting this whole ecosystem. And I think that, you know, very often bogs in Ireland, they've you know, especially for someone who grew up in suburbia like of Dublin, as I did, there's kind of a tendency to see this as almost like waste ground or ground that's not productive, or it's used for cutting turf or for a bit of fuel, but that's it really. And there's so much more to them than that.
Yeah, no, there is. And we probably should like bring it back there too. I mean, there is types of bog or you know, probably, you know, the condition of bogs really is important. Yeah. And so there's the Black Desert, which is the cutaway bog that has been stripped of all vegetation. And that's essentially dead to most life and nearly everything. So those you can forget about in a bird context, more or less. And then you get the cutaway that's damaged by drainage. But there will be still dry, you know, plants like heathers and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's quite suitable for many birds, actually. Yeah. And the cutaway is probably actually better for birds than a really, really wet sort of productive bog. So, you know, your traditional, untouched, really, really excellent condition bog is really good for lots of plants, for insects, you know, for all that good boggy stuff, your sphagnum mosses and your bog asphodels and all those lovely things and your sundews and all that. But it's actually the drier areas on the edge that have been damaged through drainage or from turf harvesting or whatever, that is quite good for when you start getting into meadow pipits. Yeah. Start getting, if we go into the uplands, we're talking about red grouse, hen harriers. Mm-hmm. They love the heather, and we'll talk a bit about that afterwards. Then when you get into the drier bits again, when you start getting into gorse and scrub, willow and all that, you're then getting into your linnets, you're getting into your yellowhammers, you're getting into your stonechats. Mm-hmm. And they, I would always associate them as bog type birds as well, certainly from the edge.
Oh, that's it, because bogs have never been a static thing. You have this transition of different habitats and the grading at the edges of them, different habitats coming in and all of that. So they can be very diverse. It's a very good habitat to go in and spend a bit of time. It rewards patience, I think, because the birds and the insect life as well and the plant life, they're not necessarily immediately visible. So if you go in there for 10 minutes and go straight back out, you might miss most of it. If you spend a morning there walking around or even just sitting down and listening and waiting, that's when it really reveals itself. And I think that's my favourite thing about bogs, just how they keep transforming in front of your eyes.
Absolutely. And like, I mean, that's really good. And there's a really good example in Offaly. We always, once a year, there's an Offaly Naturalist Field Club. It's very well established, and there's always a dawn chorus. And for years, the established site is Boora, which is sort of the flagship visitor site for Bordnamona there. And that has the sort of, you know, it's very much considered a bog site. It's a cutaway bog that's basically, most of the peat is gone. There's sort of remnants of it, but it's in all sorts of condition, mostly poor from a bog perspective. But from a bird perspective, the suite of birds you can experience there is massive. And 99% of them you wouldn't, like, you know, call traditional bog species. You know, there could be anything. I mean, you know, you're going from right through from your full wetland species, from your grebes, you know, into your sedge warblers, into your grasshopper warblers, right through to your sort of your woodland birds. So it's a fantastic site for that. But they're all peaty soils, and so like, what is a bog? I mean, we could probably do 10 episodes on that alone. It's, you know, a bog is really anything with where peat is found and peat soils and all that.
So. Yeah, and you mentioned some plants there earlier, and I think that especially in an Irish context, but also bogs and also other parts of the world too, one of the key plant there is sphagnum, this moss that's absolutely essential in many cases for the creation of these bogs. It's an incredible plant. It's a natural sponge. It just soaks up so much water, and it's incredible. And I remember as a kid going to a bog, and actually just I think it was near Abbeyleix actually, yeah, and I was just going and picking up a chunk of the sphagnum in my hand and squeezing it, the amount of water that comes out of it, and you just show this is incredible. And obviously it's over thousands and tens of thousands of years of layers of this building up and rotting down and decaying, and that's what eventually creates peat. And if you go on for a few million years, that eventually becomes coal if it goes down further again. Yeah. So it's really amazing how that this sort of these different transitions happen over such a long period of time.
Yeah, and you do hear like the lowland bogs, if anyone that's sort of like, I suppose, urbanized or living in, and isn't familiar with bogs and or what a bog should look like. Like a raised bog is called a raised bog because they're often like they're domes, and that's from because they're literally swollen with water. They're so full of water that they become swollen in the middle. And you hear the term high bog, and that's when you're right in the middle of that sort of that oldest part where the peat is the deepest. But as soon as you drain that for commercial purposes or to reclaim it to farm or whatever, it's like it the water leaves it and it sinks down, and you get a bowl effect, and it just becomes a drier habitat altogether. So, yeah, we're kind of going sort of from pillar to pillar, all sorts of places here, but it's to me, like, my brain is just sort of, you know, it's firing all sorts because they're just such interesting places. There's a lot going on, but I mean, I won't say who, but a local politician walked to Abbey Leak's bog once. And because there was a lot of, you know, a lot of interest generated and a lot of people know it's a flagship sort of community project and all that sort of stuff. And this politician, local politician, walked down the bog and I heard his comments from it was, he says, I don't know what everyone's making a big fuss about. And because he walked out to the bog, the high bog, and he looked around and he kind of went, this is a bleak landscape. The vegetation's quite low. Yeah. It's quite bleak. If the breeze is blowing in your face and it's a cold evening, like, it would cut the snot off you. And it's not like it's coming down with Hooper swans and there's hen harriers sort of buzzing you. And that's not what happens. You have to really immerse yourself, really get down into it. And you get on your hands and knees on a quaking bog, you can literally bounce on it. You'll jump up and down and the whole thing shakes like jelly, which tells you how wet they are if they're properly cared for and not fully drained. And then you start looking at the plants and like there's carnivorous plants.
Yeah.
What the hell? Like, we've got carnivorous plants in Ireland, folks. Hello. You don't need to go to like the Amazon rainforest for Venus flytraps and all that sort of lark. They're on our bogs. They're eating flies. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. The sundew particularly is the plant there, isn't it? And they have these amazing, it looks like almost like big eyelashes on them. And they have these sticky drops and they actually stick these flies and other insects in them. They're amazing. And they digest them slowly. It's gruesome, but it's effective and really unique.
It's gross. But like, and they exude a smell that to flies, the insect smells like decaying flesh.
Yeah.
So they're kind of going, nice one, dead body over here, whatever, a badger or whatever it might be, or you know, a mouse or something. And they fly over to investigate and like think that it's a free meal. And it turns out it's this carnivorous plant that then grabs them. When it gets stuck in this tentacle, it's wild. And but anyway, back to the birds. Let's go. Jeez, control yourself, man. So let's talk about some birds. So I would think there is a book called Bird Habitats in Ireland.
Yeah.
And it lists, there's a chapter on bogs, on raised bogs, lowland raised bogs, and blanket bogs. And the blanket bogs are what you get up the mountain. And they're much sort of thinner peat and they're formed differently. But we'll get to that in a minute. So we're talking about lowlands. We're talking about, let's think about, we're in Offaly, sort of Laois, Roscommon now. And
Ireland's soggy middle.
Yes, the soggy middle. Yeah, yeah, definitely. And if you go out there on a summer's day, you're going to hear meadow pipits.
Oh, yes. That for me is the quintessential bog bird, actually. And it's no matter what kind of bogland you're in, even in ones that are pretty degraded, you will still get meadow pipits. They are a fascinating little creature. They're I always describe them as looking like a wagtail in a thrush costume. They're related to wagtails. They walk on the ground. They have quite long tails, but they're brown on the back, speckled on the front. And if you go to a bog, you will see one if you keep her out. They do this lovely sort of parachuting song flights as well, particularly in the spring and the summer, where they sort of go pip, 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 and they sort of descend. It really is quite a pretty bird when you look at them up close. Not much to look at maybe from a distance, but when you get to know them, they're really charming.
I think they're really charming. Their song is really nice. Yeah. They do a kind of, you know, an amateur version of the Skylark's parachute. Not quite as high, and they do, like you say, that kind of ascending pip, pip, pip. That's how, you know, they're building up to it before they collapse back down again and they give themselves away quite a bit. And they're lovely and they're eating insects. That's why they're there. So they're ground nesters. So they find a nice bit of heather somewhere and they'll nest among that. That has its risks, but it also has its rewards. And because the heather is quite good, provides quite good cover. There's tons of insects. They literally don't need to stray like literally a foot from their nest to find enough things to feed their young and all that. And then if the young need to explode from the nest, if they're discovered by a predator or a dog or whatever, they just scatter off into the cover and they're grand. And most of the time they'll find enough cover to protect themselves until mum and dad come home. Which they're amazing, but that book would say that any bog service would show that the highest density of one species would be meadow pipits.
Yes, they really do occur in these high population densities, and that of course then in turn supports a whole lot of other things. So they're useful for a couple of purposes, but they're particularly essential to another very special bog bird, the cuckoo. They're the reason why cuckoos hang around in bogs. There's one of the Irish names for the meadow pipit is Bonaltrin na Gcuadh, the cuckoo's nursemaid. And that's because they're often the host species for the cuckoo, especially in the Midlands of Ireland. That's why the cuckoos are there.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we did an episode on eggs, which was still, from a learning perspective, still my favourite episode. I don't know how much people enjoyed it, because maybe it was a little bit academic at times. But I found it fascinating reading up about eggs and how they're formed and all the rest and how the patterns are formed. But cuckoos, because it's a difficult evolutionary sort of thing to do, process, to mimic another bird's egg, it's difficult. You can't just sort of, you know, choose the colour palette on your on an app on your phone and go for it. So they target, they tend to, populations of cuckoos tend to target a particular type of bird. And in Ireland, it's mostly the meadowpipit, because they can mimic those eggs quite a bit. Because if the meadowpipit parents come back to the nest and their eggs are normally sort of, you know, what are they? They're kind of dull red?
It's sort of speckledy kind of red. Yeah. And the nest on the ground.
And then there's this sort of bright blue egg in their nest. They'll know it's foreign and they'll either abandon the nest or they'll chuck out this foreign egg. So the cuckoos have to mimic that, so they do that. In other countries where there's more reed beds and more reed wobblers and sedge wobblers, they target those because it's easier to find them in sort of big density. But that's why cuckoos come to Irish bogs, to find meadow pipits, because both to find meadow pipits' nests to lay their eggs and then shag off and do what they do. But also, they're insectivorous, so there's plenty of insects when they're there.
Yes, and they particularly rely on the caterpillars of those large moths that you see. And bogs are perfect for those because of that rich plant diversity. When it comes to moths and butterflies as well, they're often incredibly specific when it comes to the plants that their caterpillars feed on, so therefore that they lay their eggs on. So I know when it comes to butterflies and moths as well, there's lots of focus on nectar-bearing plants like buddleia bushes for them, and that for the adults, that's an important boost. But what's often overlooked is the very specific one or two plants that each species may just lay their eggs on for the caterpillars to feed on. So if you lose that diversity in a bogland, if some of the plants start to disappear, well, then it makes life hard for the cuckoos, and also if that makes other insects disappear, it reduces the number of meadow pipits, which makes it's harder for the cuckoos to reproduce. So it's kind of like this vicious circle that one decline in one species, be it a plant or a bird or an insect indeed, it then leads to everything declining. So I think the bogs show that in a very, it's just like a natural laboratory really. You can see how all of this nature's web acts out in real time in front of you.
No, absolutely. And the moths are so fascinating. And during COVID, there's been a big drive in leash. An awfully, not even a drive, just major interest. People had a bit more time in their hands, and we've been doing an awful lot of moth trapping on Abbeleek's bog, and then my counterparts in Offaly as well, doing loads as well. So loads of new species for the both counties, just because they're one of those under yeah. sort of recorded species or species groups, and they're amazing. And some of them, and the names and the diversity, and they're just wonderful. And I was talking to a colleague just the other day, and I told her, I says, Karen, you'd love Hebrew characters. And she sort of went, sorry, come again, what? And I was like, they're just like, they're class. She said, what do you mean Hebrew character? I'm like, well, there's a lot of moths, so they kind of ran out of names, so they call them all sorts. And that is the case. Just if you flick through one of the books, you identify, and the plates, and they're just mad.
Yeah, and some of the day flying moths as well. You see, like the burnets and the cinnabars and all of these. And then that's not even talking about the hummingbird hawk moths and the bee hawk moths and all these things. The clearwing moths. Oh, they're absolutely amazing. One of the things I love to do when I talk to school kids, you know, I go to classes sometimes, and I always talk about caterpillars, how important they are for all sorts of birds in bogs, but also for blue tits in your garden. And I always say, like, a caterpillar. What is a caterpillar become? They always go, oh, butterfly. And yep, some of them do, but the vast majority of the caterpillars you encounter are moth caterpillars. We have what, about 34, 35 species of butterfly in Ireland. We have over 1,000 species of moth. There's far more of them than there are butterflies.
No, it's amazing. It's amazing. And to bring it back to birds, those moth traps are basically just a vessel, a box or a bucket, basically, with a bulb that attracts a light that attracts them. And quite often you find not only wings left around your vessel, and it's either the wren or the local robin's been in. And scuffed, or sometimes bats as well. Sometimes the wren gets the blame, but it's often the local bats as well. So they are very important in their own right, but they're also very, very important prey animal for an awful lot of species of bird.
I feel a moth episode coming on one day, Ricky.
Absolutely, 1,000% we're doing a moth episode. Yeah. Brilliant. And we'll do it live in the middle of the night, and you just hear all these mad names being thrown at you. So that'll be it. But talking about cuckoos and the meadow pipits, let's go up the mountain for a minute. And the meadow pipit attracts a very special species up there as well.
Yeah, well, the thing is, on the bogs, it can be hard to find food. So one of the species that's attracted in there very much would be the merlin, which is a bird of prey, our smallest falcon. And they specialise in hunting in these open landscapes, particularly over the bog, where they use a combination of stealth and speed to zoom low over the ground, trying to flush up birds. And up in those areas, it's the meadow pipit is their main source of food. They absolutely love them.
And they're a tiny little they're what we say, diminutive raptor compared to, you know, some of the whoppers that we do get, such as you know, the red kites and buzzards and all that sort of stuff. But They're absolutely fascinating species, and we did a good episode on Merlin with John going back, John Lusby, and how he's monitoring them with drones and all sorts in Connemara. So, yeah, a tricky little bird to connect with.
Yeah, and it's one of those ones that's the bird that where that wait and see kind of approach works really well in a bog. If you're frantically walking all over the place or running around, you might not see one. But if you sit in one place for a couple of hours, bring a lunch with you or something, you may be lucky and see one blast across. And keep an eye out if there's any kind of any razor, like a low bush or a fence post or something nearby. That's very often the perch they'll go for to sort of scan from. And then when they see likely prey, then they zoom out to get it. And they can really move when they want to. For such a bird that looks quite dainty when you see it perched, they go to this really powered flight, flapping the wings very rapidly, and they can just build up some speed very, very quickly. That's one thing I like really about falcons in Ireland. We have the three sort of breeding species. We have the Merlin, we have the Kestrel, and we have the Peregrine falcon. Very similar in terms of their body shape and structure, different in terms of their size, but also very different in terms of their hunting methods. The Peregrine, that is the does this amazing dive from the sky. And you'll see them over bogs as well. They'll go all sorts of different habitat bogs. You know, they sometimes even go for red grouse and things like that there. You'll see the Merlin doing this fast pursuit low over the ground, sort of more ambush and stealth. And then you'll see the Kestrel, which can occur in bogs as well, where they particularly like to feed on things like pygmy shrew. They will hover in the air. So three completely different strategies, all of which you can see at a bog.
There is a well-established pair of peregrine nesting on a windowsill, actually a ledge that was put there for them by the MPWS and Bord na Mona on the Edenderry power station.
Oh, right.
And they're well known, and they hunt out over the bog and over Edenderry and all sorts. So, yeah, no, those, like, because that's a huge structure in the middle of nowhere, so it's like a cliff to them. It's just, it doesn't matter what the structure is, it works very well as a sort of watchtower for them to watch birds coming and going from the bog. And also it's really, really, really safe for them from predators way up high to rear their young. So it's perfect.
Yeah, they have amazing eyesight. They're going to see any predator that does come. They'll see it from miles away, and they'll be very inaccessible. And especially in a bog where you get lots of duck in the summer or in the winter, that's great for a bird like a peregrine. In fact, in an old name for them in North America was actually the duck hawk, they used to call them, because they were so associated with catching teal and species like that.
There's an amazing phenomenon, and the I think I've mentioned it before, but the Birdwatch Ireland branch were sort of they meet in the parish centre at the Catholic Church in the middle of Port Leash, a huge structure, well known in the middle of town. And they were noticing sort of half sort of eaten birds and teal and snipe all around the car park when the lads would be sort of arriving for the meetings, and they're going, what is going on here? And it turned out a lot of those birds only sort of move at night time, any distance. And what is happening is, and other studies have shown it, is that peregrine are using the light from the town that's glowing upwards, and they're catching migratory birds, teal coming and going from the bogs locally, and snipe the same, and they're hunting for them. And then what happens is, if they lose them in the dark, they fall into the car park sort of headless. And the peregrine can't relocate them because it's dark, and you know, and it's not safe to do so or whatever. So, but then they went one step further. The famous Charles Tweeny, when he was a younger man a few years ago, he climbed the church tower and he found all these carcasses up on the very top of the church, where they use as a plucking post and a hunting spot. So yeah, they do that, and it's ideal because Port Leash is surrounded by bogland and plenty of birds coming and going, and it's amazing, really. But that's your peregrine.
Yeah, they are remarkable. It just shows you just the diversity you can get around bogs. You mentioned one of my favourite bog birds, actually. You mentioned the snipe. And I think that for me, that's one of the quintessential sounds of the bog, particularly in the evening. The first time you hear a drumming snipe, if you don't know what it is, it completely freaks you out, especially in the bleakness and vastness of a bog.
Let's have a listen.
At night in a bog, that's creepy.
It is, and it's not done with their vocal cords.
Yeah, that's right.
It's done with these especially adapted tail feathers. And I don't know the full sort of mechanism, but that's how it's...
It's the outermost tail feather on each side of the bird's tail. They're kind of especially stiffened, and they can stick them out, like little, like little, obviously, antennae sticking out. They go into a dive at a particular kind of angle, and when they reach a certain airspeed, it causes a vibration in those tail feathers. And what you're hearing is two small feathers vibrating in a bird's tail. It's absolutely crazy. And a lot of in a lot of cultures, and including in many of the Irish names for the snipe, it's a reference to goats. So the goat of the bog, or the kid of the meadows, or whatever. That's because of that. It sounds a bit like a bleating goat.
Yeah, and they need sort of wet ground because they have to probe for invertebrates. And often in the drier months you find them all on the bog, because that's the only thing that retains a bit of, you know, especially when the ground gets very hard on farmland or on our grasslands or whatever, it's very difficult for them to feed. So they sort of move into wet woodland and bog and fen, and that's where they'll feed.
And even then, in some winters when we have like really cold spell hits, we actually get reports of them coming into people's gardens. So actually, it's the species that's recorded sometimes in the Irish Garden Bird Survey, because gardens tend to be a couple of degrees warmer. These, as you said, these birds, they're waders with this long bill. They have to probe into the ground, and they need unfrozen soil to be able to do that. And I think we mentioned before in the podcast, but one of my favorite things of all about the snipe, and this is a real aha moment for lots of people when they hear it, is that snipe, when you flush them, when you're walking through the bog or wherever and one takes off, they don't fly in a straight line. They flush very rapidly and they zigzag in the sky. So they had this reputation of being really hard for a hunter to shoot. So a hunter who was talented or skilled enough to be able to shoot a snipe was known as a sniper, and that's where the name comes from. So for a lot of people, it's like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So.
Brilliant. And still to this day, there's a particular pub in Mount Melick that the gun club meets in, and you know, like, if you've the bragging rights of shooting a few snipe, like, lads, there's sort of a certain respect you get in Dowlands if you can, you know, because they're notorious. They just that zigzag and then they dive again, and then jack snipe even go shorter. And I would say that's probably an adaptation to the Merlin chasing them their whole lives.
The jack snipe, it's a species we only get in the winter. It seems that the ones that we get here in Ireland mainly breed around the Baltic Sea kind of region, maybe even as far as the Ural Mountains. They come into us in the wintertime. And I think it's a bird that it certainly occurs in bogs all across Ireland, but it's probably completely underrecorded because it's not a bird you're going to casually find. In fact, many of the records we get and the idea we have the population actually comes from hunters' banks. And they shoot a few of these in with the other snipe. They have a really strange strategy. The jack snipe, jack is an old English word meaning small, like jackdaw, small crow, jack snipe, small snipe. And they really are minuscule. Not much bigger than a sparrow, though, with a long beak and longer legs. And they have a different strategy. So the common snipe, as I said, they take off and they zigzag in the sky and they land quite a distance away. What the jack snipe does is it doesn't flush or take off until you're about to stand on it. So it's right in front of you and it puts the heart sideways in you as it takes off. Definitely. It just goes up. It goes in a big sort of high arc, like an upside down U shape, and then lands usually not that far away, but you'll almost never flush it the second time. You're going to try find it and it's either just sitting tight or it has scuttled away in the undergrowth and you haven't noticed it. And I remember once actually being at the edge of a bog because it's kind of like a reed fringed pool, and there was actually a jacksnipe out in the open. It was amazing to watch it. There's this kind of sewing machine feeding action going down with the beak, and had the telescope on. I was watching it, and it was like it was sideways on, so you could see it quite clearly in front of the reeds. And then there was something happened. It got a bit freaked out. There was maybe a predator. I thought maybe it was going overhead, and what it did, it was amazing. As I watched it, it just jumped on the spot, turned 90 degrees, all the stripes on its back lined up with the reeds, and it became invisible.
Wow.
It was exactly the same spot, and it just vanished in front of my eyes. It's mad.
Oh, that cryptic plumage just destroy you straight away. Oh, yeah, amazing. They're very hard to pick out unless they're moving at all.
Yeah, yeah. What a bird that most people aren't aware of, and certainly one that if you're out in a bog, that's a real special one to get anyway.
Yeah, no, they're super cool and very charismatic and handsome things. Let's move away from the sort of the wet bog out towards the edge of the bog. And I mentioned these both earlier. Let's talk about the stone chat first.
Yeah, so the stone chat, it's a bird that's certainly by no means confined to bogs, but those edges of bogs are particularly good for them. It's a bird that I really associate with gorse. You'll often see them perched on top of the gorse bush. And I often see photo competitions. They're always often a winning entry. It's a stone chat singing away on top of a yellow blooming gorse bush. It's gorgeous. And for me, that's a quintessential part of the Irish landscape. Gorse is actually a pretty localised plant in a world context. You find it along the fringes of Western Europe, really. That's more or less it. And so where you get that, you get the stone chat. And it's a member of the bird, the stone chat, it's a member of the same family as the robins. And in some ways, it looks like somewhat a smaller version of a robin. It's got,
it's a dumpy robin.
Little dumpy robin. It's got a red, the male has a lovely sort of red chest, but then unlike the robin, he has a lovely black head, at least in breeding plumage he does, this lovely black head with this white half collar around the neck. And they're an easy bird to see when they're in an area because they perch prominently. So even the females in the breeding season, even outside the breeding season, they just like to sit on the highest perch. If you're scanning across a bog, you're looking not on the ground, you're looking for any high point of vegetation, even if it's only a foot or so off the ground, that's where your stone chat will be.
Yeah, we might have a listen to them, actually. Yeah, funny, you mightn't pick that out, sort of.
No, it's not the most distinctive of sounds, and on a bog it can be lost with all the other sounds, because that's the thing with a bog. When you're there, you just... If you stop and listen, you're hearing birds singing, but you're hearing this buzzing of insects all the time around you.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get the mosquitoes and the midges out and all that. So many different types of bees and wasps. It's absolutely incredible. The stone chats as well, they have this remarkable call. That's where the name comes from. It sounds like someone banging two little pebbles together, like tick, 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 like this. So that's where the name stone chat comes from. It's a remarkable bird. We know that in very cold winters, it's a bird that gets hit really hard because they live in fairly exposed places. They don't migrate away from us here in Ireland. They feed on insects, so they're hit really bad. And it can take several years for their populations to recover. So if they have a couple of bad winters in a row, the population can be way down. They can even go locally extinct. But they do bounce back. They're a resilient species, and they need to be for life on the bog because it can be tough there, especially for birds that don't migrate and stay there. We talked earlier about the hirundines, the swallows and the martins. They have the luxury of arriving in the summer but then leaving in the winter. They don't have to cope with winter on the bog, but if you're a stone chat, you do, and it can be hard to get a living out of that kind of habitat.
No, totally. And one of their nearest neighbours in terms of gorse, one of my favourites is the linnet, which is a handsome bird and probably a much better singer. We might listen to that for actually a second.
That's a really pleasant one, actually, isn't it? It is. And again, that's the sound of that kind of bogland edges and also kind of rough ground. And I often associate them as well with tangled brambles by ditches alongside agricultural land. It's a nice bird like that. It's a bird that's actually been increasing in gardens in Ireland recently. You know, I know that we were talking to Brian Burke in a previous episode about the Irish Garden Bird Survey. And we've seen there's been a decline in a bird called the greenfinch in gardens due to a pandemic disease called trichomoniasis that hits them. But it seems that's had an effect that's bringing... It's allowing linnets to come more into garden feeders. So they're by no means just tied to the bogs, but it's a bird I very much associate with that bogland, those open spaces with scrubby bits around the edges. That's what you're looking for.
Yeah, and you get lovely, you get the lovely sort of like those finch flocks in the winter, and you get them just like ribbons of them sort of working along, you know, the edge of the hedge or the ditch or whatever. It's really nice to see them. And like you say, like a bog, I always associate them with the lane down to the bog rather than the middle of the bog or anything like that, where there's plenty of bramble and gorse and all that sort of stuff. They're really lovely. We might go up the hills now.
Yeah.
So now we're on the top of the sleep plumes. From point of view of unique birds, the Midlands and Laois an Offaly hasn't got a huge pile to boast about, but the sleep plumes is still a strong point or a hotbed or comparably for hen harriers and for red grouse.
Yes, two very special species and two that are really symbolic, I think, of open upland bogs, these really wide landscapes. And the thing with the red grouse, it's a really special bird because of all the birds in Ireland that are tied to habitat, it must be one of the most that's so closely tied to one plant. Their lives revolve around heather. They want heather. They're the colour of heather. They nest in heather. They feed on heather. Everything. They don't want to be anywhere there isn't heather.
Yeah, and I mean, they're impossible to see or come across. You might be very lucky if the males are aggressive and sort of flying around at each other and bits and bobs, but the male has those sort of like... those red sort of, what would you call them, eyebrows above
the... They're wattles.
And that's sometimes a giveaway, but you want to be very lucky, like, because it's sort of, like, it's low... herbage or whatever, but it's very difficult to see them through it because they're just working their way through it. And
they are, and usually the encounter, if you're walking across a bog, the first encounter is usually when you flush one of these. It just takes off in front of you. Big clatter of wings that they take off. This seems to be an adaptation to frighten a predator, so it'll be startled for a second, and this can give this grouse a chance.
Very comparable to that sort of pheasanty game bird, sort of really rapid, slappy sort of flight. And then they hug the contour of the hills and the bogs and all that. So like they vanish quite quickly around the contours, and you know, and they'll go back into cover quite quickly. So you never really get a decent look at one unless they sort of are hauled out on one of those mountain roads and they're walking across or whatever. You get them on the edge, but otherwise you want to be very lucky.
You do, and sometimes if you do see one flying away from you, you scan with your telescope particularly, you might be lucky and see where it lands. But very often, just go into the heather, they blend in perfectly, and you blink and they vanish. But like the jackknife I mentioned earlier, they're so perfectly adapted for the colour of their habitat. When they fly and they glide, as you said, perfectly, they're hugging the contours as they go. They have a really unusual wing shape. Their primary feathers are curved, so it looks like this, like almost like a bow as they're as they're gliding along. So they do fast flapping and then some gliding, and it seems that the shape of that wing, it's to allow this really rapid takeoff. It's an amazing amount of thrust when they flap those wings. They take off very, very rapidly, and often they'll call, and that call is one of the first ways that you'll hear them. And it makes sort of chattering sounds, but also it's a very distinctive part of the call. It's sort of, they go, go back, go back, go back, go back, come back, like this, and it's really distinctive on the
bird. Yeah, I always find it really hard when you see a bird's call or song described in words, but the go back phrase really does make sense, and we'll listen to that now, and people will get their head around that quite quick.
Yeah, you can hear it there. There you go. Yeah.
And the way now, and this is completely illegal unless you're licensed to do so. So do not do it. But to monitor them, because they're very tricky to detect, they do sort of play the male's call through loudhailers. And then the male, if it's holding territory, will aggressively sort of call back, or sometimes come out of cover and attack the person with the speaker. So the MPWS will be doing that in the sort of traditional SPAs, special protection areas for red grouse. They're probably under-detected for that reason, where they're not being sort of actively monitored by that audio sort of lure. Methodology, but so they're probably doing okay, and you know, we do have quite a bit of heather and stuff. And I mean, in the UK, where there's commercial shoots for them, they manage the heather and they do controlled burns and they do all that sort of stuff. And there are bog groups and shooting clubs in this country that have reintroduced them onto bogs and do manage the habitat for them. But they probably were never found in huge density anyway, and they're very, very much in those shooting estates where they do manage the heather. They would be artificial sort of dense levels, so it's not really comparable to a natural sort of.
I've seen them in Yorkshire, for example, out there in the moors, and there was a sort of a driven, like beaten grouse shoot going along, and there was just like clouds of these things coming across, flying across the road and crashing into fences and all this, and it's just like, it was funny. I remember also being once in the Scottish Highlands up near Aviemore. It was very tough winter actually, and it was snow everywhere. It was really interesting there to see the red grouse, normally so camouflaged, all the moorland covered in snow. They stuck out like sore thumbs, like these dark, almost like black in that kind of contrast, sitting all over the hillside. You realise there's actually loads of them there in Scotland. And that's the thing about them, actually, the red grouse, it's often classed as a subspecies, or perhaps two subspecies, the Irish one maybe distinct subspecies, of a much more widespread species called the willow grouse, or the willow ptarmigan in North America, it's often known as. And this is found all across the northerly latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere. You get them in you get them across Asia, across North America. But all of those populations, those birds turn white in the winter to blend in. And the red grouse that we have in Ireland, in Britain, and in the Isle of Man as well, where it occurs, they don't turn white in the winter. And there is some talk that actually perhaps they are a valid species in their own right. And if they are a valid species, then they would be completely confined to these islands in our archipelago here, which gives us actually even greater conservation responsibility for this species.
Yeah, and they are, I think they're red listed on the Birds of Conservation Concern. So we are worried about them, and they're under the same. I mean, we talked about hen harrier and other things, and you know, a lot of it is habitat loss through forestry and drainage of bogs. And important to say this, to qualify this, hen harriers will move to the uplands to breed.
Yeah.
In sort of in blanket bogs and in heather cover, and they nest on the ground as well, and they're preying on meadow pipits. That's why they're up there. So they're sort of chasing around their prey. They're going, and then they're returning to the lowland bogs quite often, or marshes and reed beds and stuff, to roost, because they've got nice cover on the edge of lowland bogs, and they've got loads of meadow pipits to prey on all winter in the hinterland and all that sort of stuff, and then back up to the mountain when it's less harsh in the spring, where there's less things to compete with and everything else. So that's what brings them up there, rather than sort of any other reasons.
Yeah, and it's a bird that's very adapted for that kind of landscape. So it might be strange to think of a bird of prey nesting on the ground, but that's generally what hen harriers do. They nest in amongst the heather and other vegetation if they find it in the area. So from that point of view, it's a species you can see up there, and they're absolutely, absolutely glorious.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And it's great to have both of those species and have the whole mountain sort of protected as SPA and SAC and all that for those species. And so they're getting to it now. It's early spring, and that's what they're up to. So it's fascinating that we have them. And the males, of course, are this handsome sort of grey-blue.
Yes.
And they're probably a bit more infrequently seen. And then the females, what we call ringtails, same size and shape and all that, but they've got this sort of big white block of feathers on above their sort of at their tail, just at the top of their tail.
Yes, yeah, so lower back. For many centuries, there was thought there were two separate species. The male and female look very different. We've talked before about the strategy sometimes of what they call sexual dimorphism, when male and female differ. You can see that. A very good example would be many ducks. So the mallard, the male and female look completely different. Even more so the hen harrier. The male and female, you would not think that they're the same species. Same structure, and this very amazing way of flying very slowly above the ground, with the sort of gliding on this wings held in a shallow V. They have this almost owl-like facial disc to help direct the sound into their ears when they're hunting there. But the male and female is a completely different colour. The male is a particularly beautiful creature. There's this lovely bluey grey colour, as you said, black wingtips, this crisp contrast, and the female with the mini brown plumage with this white patch on above the base of the tail. So really special.
Yeah, no, they're absolutely beautiful and really special.
Loughborough is a very good place for them in the winter, isn't it? So often people ask me, you know, where have a good chance of seeing a hen harrier, and I say, if you go to Loughborough in the winter, you have a very good chance.
You have, and they hunt over the lakes there, and you've got lots of open vistas and sort of comfortable places to hang out and wait for them, because it can be a bit of a waiting game. And often you see a sort of, like you say, a large raptor coming low over the reeds or whatever, and you can be pretty sort of sure it's going to be a hen harrier or sometimes something a bit rarer. But we might wait for the full hen harrier episode to talk about other options in the harrier family. That's it. So, I mean, let's do bird of the week. And I want to talk about a species that is now, has always been associated and synonymous with bogs. We've lost it in recent centuries in this country, but only to return itself naturally in recent years, and that is the crane, the common crane. And again, I have to qualify this. Growing up, the crane in our house was the grey heron.
Yeah.
And Grandad would say, and Granny and Ma would say, oh, Jesus, the crane was milling the trout down the river there today. And I go, oh, Grandad, that's a grey heron. Come on, let's not go there. Crane's a different species. So you often hear them sort of colloquially referred to, grey herons colloquially referred to as cranes, but the crane actually is a much bigger species altogether, associated very much with fen and reed bed and bogs. And in recent years, they've returned to have successful breeding attempts in bogs in Offaly. And this year I hear they're back on territory already. And so tell me about cranes.
It's been fantastic, because that's a species that's been extinct as a breeder in Ireland for more or less 400 years. So often, on this podcast, and when we're talking about wildlife generally in Ireland, there's a lot of doom and gloom and a lot of sad stories of things that disappeared. So it's nice to actually be talking about what seems to be becoming a success, moving the right direction. I know it's only one pair, but still, that's much better than no pairs for 400 years. As you said, Ricky, it is a really unique bird. There's nothing like it. I could see why, when it became extinct in Ireland, why the name crane transferred to the grey heron, because it's something that would have been a very important part of the folk psyche. It's illustrated in the book of Kells. It's a species that was associated so much with Ireland and with these wild places, both because of the areas where it would live, but also because this amazing bugling call that they have. And I could see how, you know, it's similar in some ways, at least superficially, to a heron. It's predominantly grey, very long legs, very long neck, very long pointed bill. Herons are big birds, but they're absolutely dwarfed by the crane. The crane is massive. So it's really the only bird that you'd see in Ireland that's almost the height of yourself when you're out. You know,
up to a man's shoulder easily. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, and you said you mentioned a bugling there. Let's cut straight to that now and have a listen.
I'll tell you a story here, Ricky. The very first time I ever saw cranes in my life, I was a teenager, and I was with my late father. He lived in France at the time, and it was winter, and there's an area into the centre of France where it's known for loads of cranes coming in. They're birds that are migrating. They're from Scandinavia, and some of them go on then as far as Spain. It's a stop-off area for them, and some spend the winter. I'd never seen one before, and I arrived, and there was a blizzard blowing. It was freezing. We're standing there, looking out across from... looking down these fields, nothing but hedges and fences there. I was really disappointed. I really, really wanted to see a crane. And then something came flapping in, and it was a white-tailed eagle. And all of a sudden, all the hedges took flight. And I realised I'd been watching about 1,000 cranes in a line across the field.
Wow.
And it blew my mind. And they all started calling together, and it was astounding. It was hairs on the back of your neck kind of moment. And I just realised, these are seriously impressive. And to think that we once had that spectacle in the Irish Midlands, hopefully we will again one day. They're absolutely amazing.
Absolutely. Look, the bogs in Ireland, geez, where do we start? We've absolutely abused them. But there's, thank God, there's a new wave of effort and investment and knowledge and all that stuff being injected into the bogs, and hopefully, and I mean, there's going to be, I mean, we see with turf cutting the last decade, it's been tricky culturally and, you know, in various localities and regions in the country, and there's going to be problems along the way. And now, you know, there's talk of reclaiming the peat soils off some of the farmers that have spent 100 years claiming that land, and that's going to be tricky and difficult. But it is where we're at, and hopefully at the end of the day the likes of the crane will benefit, and we'll all benefit from that. And the cranes though themselves, you mentioned like how we go back in our psyche and our folk memory and folklore and all that sort of stuff. And like at one point in our very shady past, they were very, very much sort of put up there as the sort of the harbinger of the spring.
Yeah,
they were very much sort of looked to as a sign of spring and hope and all that sort of stuff. And when the English came along and noticed that we sort of really worshipped these animals, they made it their business to get rid of them.
Yeah.
And they put you know, they put sort of a price on their heads, and eventually got rid of them from our countryside. And like you say, the folk sort of tried to hold on to that and probably attach that name to the herons that still were sort of extant. And, you know, so it's still like those things, and bogs and turf cutting and all that is deep inside us. And it's not always an easy change or an easy sort of...
It's amazing, you know, back in medieval times, the crane was actually a very popular pet in Ireland, particularly among the Irish nobility. And I remember seeing some paper actually saying that it was probably the third most popular pet after dogs and cats in Ireland was the crane. And that's the thing is, the thing with cranes, of course, is as chicks, they imprint very much on the first figure they see. So for reintroduction programs, you see with cranes in places, in other parts of Europe and other species of cranes, because many other species in the world, a lot of them are very, very rare. They can often get them to migrate because they imprint on their handler or their keeper, and then they'll follow them anywhere. So they get into microlight aircraft and they'll follow them anywhere they go, because they're so tuned into that. And I think, yeah, they're seen as very, very loyal pets.
Yeah, that's just wacky. But I can, yeah, I just can't see... Don't want to start off a trend of like walking your crane down sort of pennies on a lead.
I got the crane is for life, not just for Christmas.
Deadly, really enjoyed it, and yeah, until next time.
Yeah, thank you everybody for listening. Please do spread the word about our In Your Nature podcast. We want as many people to listen as possible. So if you enjoy it, hopefully some of your friends and family and colleagues would enjoy it too. Don't forget about us at Birdwatch Ireland. Go to birdwatchireland.ie. You can find details of membership about lots of our bogland birds and some of the projects we're working on there. We mentioned hen harriers. Check out the Birdwatch Ireland YouTube channel for some lovely videos of hen harriers and other bogland creatures there too. And just to finish, as always, by saying In Your Nature is edited by Anne-Marie Kelly. The series is supported by Laois Offaly and Westmeath County Council and the Heritage Council.